Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, July 24th, 2010, and I'm Harley Schlanger, and I will be your host. It was about a little more than 2 weeks ago when in one of the LaRouche PAC television weekly reports, Lyndon LaRouche spoke of his role as a kind of advisor and director of governments in the wing. He was talking about the complete and utter failure of the Obama administration, largely due to the failed personality of the president, the Nero, or now more like Hitler in the bunker, aspect of the president of the United States. But more importantly, Lyndon LaRouche was talking about the discussion process underway among political figures globally, especially from Russia, India, and China, and from the United States, as well as economists who were discussing and studying LaRouche's proposals, his proposal to go with a bankruptcy reorganization of the current system, a global Glass-Steagall, move to a new Bretton Woods with fixed exchange rates, and so on. And what he said is that while many people have come to recognize not just his authority on this, but that he's right, most of them have a different time frame. That the thinking among some of these networks in the United States is that you have to wait until after the Democratic Party is humiliated in November so that maybe with the new Congress and the beginning of 2011 you can have a change. Now in response to that, LaRouche wrote a statement last week, the time is now the end game, and he talked about the fact that we have no time to wait, we have to move now. And so that was his point in emphasizing that while he's prepared, he's too old to run for president, he said, but while he's prepared to provide an advisory function, the population has to be moved now. The mass strike process has to get over its anger, its flailing, and take on the leadership of and the ideas of Lyndon LaRouche. Now, at about that same time, there was an historic webcast from Berlin, which featured Helga Zepp LaRouche, the leader of the Busso Party in Germany, and Jacques Cheminade, who had just announced his campaign for the president of France. Joining me today on the LaRouche Show will be Jacques Cheminade, and we'll be talking about this question of the timing, because, you know, some people said, well, why is Jacques announcing now? The French elections aren't until 2012. And so we'll have a chance to discuss with Jacques on the program today his sense of the timing. Jacques, for those who don't know him, has run for president of France before. He's a well-respected economist, very well known among political figures in France, and feared, I might add, by some of them, as he was targeted in the same way Lyndon LaRouche was by French political police and financial authorities who tried to destroy him. But Jacques has a great familiarity with the United States, having spent some time here. I've had the pleasure of spending time with Jacques in Paris and in France and doing meetings with him, and I can tell you that this is someone who is quite a political organizer. So, Jacques, welcome to the program today.
Hi.
Happy to be with you. Let me start by just asking why you did announce your candidacy now when you did.
Well, because it's here and now. We are, it's the end game of a system internationally, and at the same time we are in the middle of a regime crisis in France. All the bad habits of the entire French political class are called now into question by a set of scandals. And in this situation, with an international disintegration threat, immediate, and the disintegration of the French political system, in that situation, nobody really has a sense of the international situation. They have information, but they are emotionally disconnected with the consequences. Nobody understands really the issue of the nation state. And nobody has a clear understanding of what a credit-based economy is against a monetarist economy. And that's because they don't understand that the basis of an economy is human physical creativity. This issue of creativity is something that both in the majority and mainly around Sarkozy, and but also in the opposition, has been lost. They have lost the sense of a nation because they have lost the sense of human creativity. Look at Sarkozy. He is not attracted and perverted by money. He is money. He is an incarnation of money. He's nothing but money. And he is incommensurable with morality. He is absolutely unable to lead a fight or to go in the direction of a Glass-Steagall. Why? Because he is in this universe of money, of gambling. And at a time when all the gambling debts have to be thrown away internationally, he gave the authorization in the internet in France, in the web, on the web, to gamble. So, and he distributed the authorizations to his coterie of parvenus. For example, Dominique de Seigne, who is the owner of the Barrère casinos in France. Dominique de Seigne is a personal friend of Nicolas Sarkozy. He organized the celebration when Sarkozy was elected at the Fouquet's in Paris with all this coterie and all the people like the Bouygues, the Dassault, the Stéphane Corbitz, all these people around Sarkozy has been given the gambling rights. How a guy doing that nationally could internationally oppose the banks, oppose the gamblers? He can't.
Well, Jacques,
that's
so
why I'm candidate now.
Well, now let's take a look at Sarkozy a little bit, because a lot of the American listeners don't know a whole lot about him, except they know he's a little short and that he married whatever you want to call her, a celebrity, let's say, polite. But he himself, besides the, well, let me put it this way. The corruption that you just mentioned, the gambling, the support for derivatives, the alliance he has with the leading banks of Europe, all of that is also mirrored in his personal behavior, because there are these scandals now that have emerged that you mentioned. What is the nature of the scandals, and do these actually threaten his presidency?
The worst scandal is that when he went to England, he said that he was so happy to go to bed in the sheets of the Queen at Buckingham Palace, because this was the thing that excited him the most in all his life. So that's a real scandal. In that sense, he's British by intention, absolutely, because he's money. He's a merchant. He's a financier. So if you look at the scandals, it becomes extremely interesting. He was the head of the Balladur campaign, who was candidate against Chirac in 1995.
And that's the campaign that you were in, right?
That's the election where I was candidate. I was about to come to that. So Balladur deposited in his account 10 million francs, which is at this point about $1.5 million dollars, in cash and in currency, which is absolutely forbidden according to French law. And the Constitutional Council accepted the Balladur account. Who was in the Balladur camp, the spokesman for Balladur and the head of his campaign, Nicolas Sarkozy? So the Constitutional Council accepted the Balladur campaign account because he had to accept also Chirac, who was involved in dirty tricks and was overspent because there is a maximum authorization to spend in France. Chirac had overspent. So, but Chirac was elected, so they could not reject his account. So they decided they could not reject Balladur, and they decided to reject my account for some really absolutely illegal reason against their own law, their own principles. But they accepted Balladur, and the money from that Balladur sent in cash. There are many stories about it. Balladur pretended first it was money from his supporters, but he had barely enough supporters, and all the currencies were 500 franc currency, so a supporter would not give that in cash at any moment. Then he said it was a secret fence of the government. Why he said that, which is always already quite bad, and he should be rejected if only for that, because he was involved in the Augusta submarines sale to Pakistan. And these Augusta submarines were sold to Pakistan with, of course, a backsheesh, and a payback. And they were sold hastily, and this money from the contract was supposed to come back, and a part of it came back in the Balladur accounts. So then Chirac, when he was elected, decided to stop the payments to the go-betweens. And among the go-betweens is a guy called Ziad Takieddine, a Druze Lebanese, who claims to be a friend of Sarkozy and is a friend of Sarkozy. So Ziad Takieddine organized that. He did not get the money, and the people involved did not get the money because Chirac cut the deal because he did not want the money to go to the Balladur Sarkozy camp at the time. Then the Pakistanis, who did not get the money, in a revenge, in an act of revenge, bombed a bus with French officials from the French Navy administration who were taking care of the submarines in Pakistan, and there were 11 killed. So there is blood in this, and it's a big, big scandal. The interesting point in that, it's also Ziad Takieddine, who officially, and this was recognized by the Sarkozy people, arranged a deal according to which Gaddafi released these famous Bulgarian nurses. And it is said that Cecilia Sarkozy, who went to get to see Gaddafi, got money from Gaddafi as a payback to accept the divorce with Nicolas Sarkozy. So this is a second scandal. And the lawyer of Cecilia Sarkozy, the first wife of Sarkozy, was one George Kijman, a former minister of François Mitterrand. Now George Kijman is a lawyer of Madame Bettencourt in the Bettencourt scandal. So you have all this connection, which it seems complicated to understand, but in fact it's very simple. The same people getting money, money, and money in all directions from all possible sources. And this is also the issue of the Bettencourt-Sarkozy-Wirth case.
Well, Jacques, why is this emerging now then? Because you mentioned Balladur is 1995. Some of these other things are spread over the last 5 to 10 years. Is it coming out now because of the crisis in general, or how does it work?
In Venice, when you don't take care of the canals, something brews underneath, and then suddenly bubbles pop up, and they tend to release very bad smells. So this is what's happening. The stables of Augias have not been cleaned. So the whole thing, in a period of crisis, of extreme crisis, is coming on the table. The Balladur case, the Bettencourt case, is really remarkable because in that you have everything you can imagine. The manipulation of the justice, the intervention of the executive in the middle of the tribunals and with the prosecutors, the confusion of powers, all the scandals of intervention, and in the middle of that, the advisor to Madame Bettencourt, the financial advisor, who stole money also, 5 million euros from her, Patrice Demestre, is a descendant of Joseph Demestre. Joseph Demestre, European counter-revolutionary, and the ideologue of the provocation of a French revolution and a bloodthirsty revolution to create the conditions for a counter-reform, to a counter-revolution, and the establishment of a anti-republican power. So you have all that involved in this case, at the same time as the L'Oréal, Madame Bettencourt owns 31% of L'Oréal, the international company, the famous international company.
Right.
So the L'Oréal firm was founded by one Eugène Schuller, the father of Madame Bettencourt. Eugène Schuller was a main financier of the Cagoule, anti-Semite, worse than the Pétain circus in Vichy, collaborator with the Nazis, admirer of the new Europe of Hitler. So this guy had as friends André Bettencourt, the future husband of Liliane Schuller, Madame Schuller, the daughter of Schuller, the founder of L'Oréal, André Bettencourt, François Adal, and François Mitterrand. All these three people protected at the liberation because they turned their coats in 1943, and they became part of the Free French. So they turned their coats in 43, and they protected Schuller at the liberation. And as a favor, Bettencourt got the girl. It's like in a Western. Bettencourt got the girl and married Liliane Schuller, Liliane Bettencourt now. Mitterrand got the money. He got it for politics. He got a position in the L'Oréal Votre Beauté magazine, and then he got a lot of money from this Bettencourt, pretending he never did, but he did. And then François Dalle became the head of L'Oréal. So these three guys were at the basis of all this reconversion of people who had gone on the bad side with the Nazis during the war, and then on the other side in 42-43. And this is a tragedy of France, a tragedy in French history. So now everybody taking advantage of this type of situation tried to get the more money from Madame Bettencourt that they could. Madame Bettencourt is 87. She's deaf because she had tuberculosis when she was young, and she's abused by all these people, including a gigolo artist called François-Marie Bagnier. So the gigolo artist was protected by the maître, protected by Woerth, who is now the budget, the labor minister of Sarkozy, who is in charge of the austerity imposed to the pensioners, and before he was budget minister, and before, in 1995, this Woerth, who is now with Sarkozy, and was a treasurer of Sarkozy's campaign in 2007, before in 1995, he was Chirac's treasurer for the Chirac campaign. So you have the whole thing there. You have the whole nest of people exposed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this happened, like it always happened in history, in the tragic moments of history, a small thing throws suddenly a light on a big thing. And the beginning of the scandal was this François-Marie Bagnier, this gigolo that tried to arrange a special relation with Madame Bettencourt and got 1 billion euros from her, 1 billion euros. Not all for him, people say in Paris. Probably he was a conduit for political favors. So he got this billion, this François-Marie Bagnier, and the daughter of Madame Bettencourt went before the judges and before the prosecutors of the Nanterre tribunal and said, well, this is a scandal, my mother should be protected, and she has been under what they call in France abuse of influence of this Bagnier. So the prosecutor Courroy rejected the case. And then this prosecutor tried to cover up everything. But Bettencourt's daughter had a lawyer called Metzner. So this Metzner lawyer, who was also the lawyer of Villepin in the Clairstream case, the opposition between Villepin and Sarkozy, followed another path of proceedings before the tribunals and managed to restart with the case. And then, and little things in history always lead to big things. One of the servants of Madame Bettencourt put a registration device in her room and got tapes. And now there are the secret tapes that the daughter got, and then the tribunal has them. And this exposes fully the influence of Sarkozy in the case, through Patrick Huard, who was the head of cabinet of the justice minister and Sarkozy's man, through the judge Courroy, who tries to cover up and who speaks to the maître and Huard all the time. This is confusion of justice and and executive power, an absolute confusion.
Jacques,
so this
is it big enough that this could topple the Sarkozy government?
Sarkozy is finished in a way at this point. Not only for that, but because even the old people that are the pensioners see him imposing austerity on their pensions. They don't like too much. They don't like that too much. And the gambling, he doesn't realize, he doesn't, Sarkozy is at a point where he is no more, I don't want to compare Sarkozy and Lafayette, but poor Lafayette, it's not fair. But the syndrome has a similarity. Sarkozy doesn't want to see what happens around him. And he is convinced that he can manage. He intervened on July 12th in a one-hour TV interview, interviewed by a journalist called David Pujadas. And this journalist was like the servant of Sarkozy, and it appeared before the whole population that Sarkozy tried to stop the mess by giving this interview to a guy who acted like a pupil or a servant of the president, and everybody's laughing at it at this point. Sarkozy has lost control of things. He has absolutely lost control of things. What people see, and what I said in my declaration of candidacy, De Gaulle wanted to make out of Europe a cathedral, and now with Sarkozy and the present leaders of the European Union, it's a house of pains.
Well, you're listening to Jacques Cheminade, a candidate for president in France, discussing the scandals there, scandals which I would say are part of the corruption which we see on the economic side of things. And I'd like to turn to the economy, Jacques, because this is where I know you have a great deal of influence among certain networks in France, people who are looking for an alternative. And we just saw this crazy thing from the European Central Bank, the so-called stress tests, where they said they were going to test to see if the banks are solvent. And even from the press, which usually is defenders of the banks, you have, for example, the Daily Telegraph, said that not only were the banks allowed to include even the most spurious assets when calculating their Tier 1 capital, but the definition of stress didn't actually appear that stressful, with a set of assumptions in the worst-case scenario that appeared to be far from the worst many in the markets have feared in recent months. And there are a number of articles from Spain, from especially Britain, making fun of these stress tests. So I'd like to ask, what is your sense of the actual situation with the banks there? And to what extent is the idea of a global Glass-Steagall gaining support as a result of this?
The banks have a great confidence in each other. That's why they don't lend money to each other. No, the whole thing is a joke. The stress test is a laughable swindle. What they say, all the figures are messed up and wrong. And it's what they take as a situation of stress has nothing to do with what is going to happen in the next month and a half. They don't want to see the future. They don't want to go into the unknown. They think that by extrapolation of what they know, they can master a process. And they are absolutely wrong. For example, Schäuble, the German finance minister, came to Paris, and he discussed with the French. He participated in a French Council of Ministers. So what he said at the end, he praised austerity. He said, all the French press describes him as a German apostle of austerity. And in Les Echos, he calls the British austerity measures truly impressive and admirable. And he expresses great respect about the measures that France announced, including against the pensioners. So the worst of it, of course, is in England, where they call to cut public expenses by 20 to 40%. And you look at these two guys, this Cameron and Clegg, the head of the coalition between the liberal Democrats and the conservatives. And these are Eton Oxbridge hypocritical fascists. You can read that on their faces. And Cameron was in the United States. His first visit was not for the United States. He came to France to discuss with Sarkozy. And Sarkozy went to London on June 18th to celebrate the Gaulle's call of June 18th, 1940 in London. And Cameron behaved with him in the most obnoxious way. He said, for us, June 18th is a celebration of Waterloo. But now with the Gaulle, we forget and we celebrate the Gaulle's call. Then he said, we agree now, France left NATO and we agree with France joined NATO, the military decision body of NATO, and this we agree, and it's a proof of the French, British friendship as expressed by the Gaulle. And it's the Gaulle who had France getting out of NATO. So this is unbelievable. And then he said, and we share the same commitment for the cause of liberty in Afghanistan, and we fight on the same side, on the right side. So this was absolutely incredible. Everybody in France, the comment was, this thing is getting wild. The old Gaullists are furious, even certain socialists are reacting, and the old communists are also furious. But the problem is that all this left is infected by ecologism, and the ecologists, because they are not properly fought, they are getting quite a bit of influence now, not only with the ecological party, which is called Europe Ecologie, but throughout the opposition.
Well, so, let me go back to the stress test and a couple of things on the economy, because you've raised a couple of these things that are quite important. The austerity, Trichet just came out with a very strong statement saying, we need drastic austerity, and there are a couple of others. But I want to get at this question of just one aspect of the stress test. One of the things that happened in the United States is that they allowed the banks to keep the bad assets on their books at face value. And so as long as the government is willing to provide funds to those banks when they need funds to cover costs, they're able to look fairly good. That is, their so-called Tier 1 capital is phony assets backed by government money. Is that pretty much the same in France?
Yeah, sure. Sure, and when they have toxic assets and they have problems, they go to the European Central Bank, and the European Central Bank, they deposit their toxic securities or bills at the European Central Bank, and they get in exchange cash for 1 week, 3 months. In the past, it was 1 year, now it's only 3 months. So, and this appears as part of the equity. It's considered as part of what the banks have consolidated. And also, there is all the money that is not considered a danger because the banks don't plan to sell it. So it's securities that they don't plan to sell until the end.
So they can keep it.
This is considered not a danger.
They can keep it at the original market value,
exactly.
Though if they tried to sell it, it would be
especially for bonds.
Yes. Okay. So, and then under those circumstances, how are they planning? I mean, we talk about the austerity. Trichet is saying, okay, the bailout is over. Now we're going with austerity, but from what I understand, they're going to continue with the bailouts, but they are serious about killing off the pensioners, the sick, the elderly, the poor.
It's a Greek treatment, bailout for the financial institutions and austerity for the people and the middle classes. And now what you see is the anger of the middle classes. In fact, the austerity policy followed by the European governments, and in particular the French, will hit the youth, students looking for a flat, the handicapped, and pensioners. So it's the entire middle class and working class. And
are
it's exactly the policy
of
Laval in 1935 and Brüning in Germany in 32.
Are you seeing a kind of mass strike process emerging? I know we did some mass leafleting back in the fall of last year. Are we seeing the kind of mass strike ferment that we've seen in the United States yet among the middle classes in France?
At this point, what you see is a lot of anger and resentment, but people express it in an inward-turned way. It's not yet outward-turned. So some are expressing it openly. For example, there was a scandal with General Motors in Strasbourg. General Motors, you know, is owned now by the American government. Mm-hmm. And the workers accepted a cut of their wages by 10%. And they are, of course, they're angry against Obama. They said, we believe that Obama was good. Now we have a 10% cut in our wages. Some of us are kicked out. And then General Motors said, that's not enough. We want to cut your holiday time. And we want to be able to have you working 60 hours if we want in summer, and only 30 or 25 hours in winter. We can completely control the agenda of the working hours. So these people are furious and are understanding the connection between the American policies and the European policies at this point. The General Motors story in Strasbourg is very important. There are many others. But overall, it has not yet exploded. Nonetheless, there would be a big, big demo on September 7 of all the trade unions and all the opposition against the cuts in pensions that the Sarkozy government is planning. So Sarkozy is quite concerned by that. He pretends not to be, but he's quite concerned by that. And at this point, the Minister of Labor who is running this thing is Wirth, the one involved in the scandals.
Right.
So the government is very weakened and people are angry. And anger sometimes can explode with a small thing like the case of Wirth. Wirth did nothing except to work according to the rules of the game, to get as many money as he could for his party and the operations of the government and orders of Sarkozy. That's why people are saying the scandal is the Wirth-Betancourt-Sarkozy scandal. It's not Betancourt, it's not Wirth-Betancourt, it's also Sarkozy. And people are seeing that more and more. That's why I call for the resignation of Sarkozy. Sarkozy should go, same as Obama. The extreme right wing and the extreme left also call for the resignation of Sarkozy. But they do that with no program and on the basis of hatred. I said that I call for the resignation of Sarkozy with neither pleasure nor hatred because I despise him too much to hate him. So, and he has to go because at this point he's not anymore in a position to go for Glass-Steagall.
Okay, now this is what I want to ask you about next. I want to move into this area because I know from a number of meetings that you and I did when I was in Paris and several other cities, that there were economists already back last October who were talking about global Glass-Steagall, who were interested in Mr. LaRouche's ideas. Many of them have known you for some time. Is there, we had the phony regulatory bill, the Dodd-Frank bill, where they kept Glass-Steagall out, they kept regulation of derivatives out. How closely was that followed in France, and are people moving toward a Glass-Steagall perspective now?
The government is negotiating with the German government of this famous Berlin Club approach, which means that in the case of a bankruptcy of a state or of a national bankruptcy, banks and private investors should be exposed to states in difficulty, would only recuperate at best half the nominal value of their loans. This has nothing to do with Glass-Steagall. This is only a restructuration in case of collapse of a state. So the thing that I want to point out is that they consider the collapse of a European state. It's not something out in some fairy tale. It's happening. The French and German governments consider it may happen, but they don't go for Glass-Steagall at all at this point. And the opposition doesn't. We were told by the head of the opposition directly, one of our young members of the LIM in France, he was told directly by Martine Aubry at a when privately that she's in favor of Glass-Steagall, she's considering it, but it's not good for an electoral campaign because people cannot understand such an issue. So you have to understand how this oligarchical principle work. People are among themselves, they don't want to be, even when they understand something and what it means, they don't want the amateurs, what they see as the amateurs from outside, being involved in their own dirty little games. So that's what's happening. The important thing is what you stressed. At this point, there are important economists in France, and we saw them at the Aix-en-Provence meeting of the Circle of Economists, where, by the way, you had a few Americans like Robert Reich. So at this meeting, we polarized the discussion, even if we were most of the time outside and not inside, because we went with Glass-Steagall, and we were Glass-Steagall people. So some economists like Morin is a very important one from Toulouse. He hates the behaviorists. He understands very well what it means, because in Toulouse you have the French behaviorist, Tirol, who is a friend of Blanchard, who is a chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. So Tirol has been giving a lot of money by the French government to go in a counter-operation against Morin. So Morin is calling for Glass-Steagall. We had a long discussion together. Stéphane Cossé from the Modem, he's an advisor to Bayrou. He's the main advisor to Bayrou, also is for Glass-Steagall. Jean-Paul Paulin, who is an economist from Orléans, is also for Glass-Steagall. And there are four or five others. Very interestingly, Dominique Plion, who is a very clever left-wing financial economist from ATTAC, he's at this point acting president of the Scientific Advisory Board of ATTAC. He never wanted to be involved with us because he's not very courageous. But he came out in favor of Glass-Steagall, saying, I think it is necessary to separate the activities of retail banks from those of investment banks to create a strict separation between both of them in order to protect popular savings and credit to companies. So he said there is no real progress on this issue in Europe and it is worrisome. So Plion, is very significant that Plion went for that because next to him, sitting as honorary speaker, was James Galbraith.
Mm-hmm. From the United States.
Yeah, of course, from Texas.
Yeah. Well, now, Jacques, with this kind of groundswell, at least in these kinds of circles, we have Lyndon LaRouche's forecast of having reached a boundary condition of the current circumstances where the only way to save this system is going to be the most vicious, murderous austerity, which we're already seeing. At the same time, you have the crisis with the banks, the crisis with the so-called pigs countries of Europe, but also what you're talking about, France, the political crisis. Can the European Union hold together under these circumstances? One of the things Mr. LaRouche always says is that the United States is the key center of the battle. What are your thoughts on the question of the future of the European Union?
When waters become muddy, sharks tend to bite each other. So I don't think that this could continue very long. It's impossible to figure out what will happen because in an oligarchical setting, things go under the table. So they kick their legs, they do whatever they do under the table. It's not on the table. The only signs of tensions come from indirect expressions, indirect moments. And then you have suddenly an enraged face of Sarkozy, a nasty face of Cameron, and Merkel fearing to be kicked out soon because her coalition is extremely weak at this point. So I call for the resignation of Sarkozy, because at this precise moment, saying it has nothing to do with the presidential campaign on 2012, it should be here now because of this crisis. So it's a way to communicate to people the fact that there is a boundary condition, because most of the people that think in terms that something has to be changed, that a new direction has to be taken, don't understand the agenda of the connection between the impact on the minds of people of an austerity program and the measures to be taken economically. They see that as in a kind of different universes. They don't see the unity of the universe because they have not a sense of what is a creative human mind. The best of them.
That's the same problem here, where Lynn has been talking about the disconnect that exists between people who see their own lives falling apart, and yet they're bombarded with stories about the recovery and they get confused. I wonder if you could just tell us, give us a picture of what the economic circumstances are in France, because most Americans are told that France and Germany are doing quite well. And just give us a sense, from the farm sector to the workers in the cities to the middle class, what's it like in France right now?
France has lost all of its industry. Now the portion in the gross national product, the portion of industry in France, relatively, is under that of England, that of the United Kingdom. So industry has been destroyed, in particular the subcontracting sector. What's left is aeronautics, part of the nuclear industry, and what's connected to the railways. These sectors are more or less under control. For the rest, for example, the automotive sector, it's a disaster. And all the mechanics mechanic industries have left. So you have only 12% of the gross national product involving industry. You have 3% in agriculture, 5% in different things connected to agriculture and industry, and 80% are services. So it's a service economy, service-based economy. And three things happen at the same time. The purchasing power of pensions in the last 20 years went down by 20%, and they want create a situation where they would be even more lowered. So 20%. At the same time, in the gross national product, income portion has diminished by 10%. And there is the same tendency, a bit less, but the same tendency as in the United States. The 5% wealthier control more and more of the national wealth, while the 20% poorer have lost control of everything, and about 50%, the middle classes, are started to be hit now. The difference probably with United States, the only one, is that it's a safety net. There is still a safety net, which is a social security system coming from World War II and the hospital system, which still works quite well.
Is that under attack now?
Yes, absolutely under attack. It's destroyed. For example, in France you have the public hospitals and the private clinics, as they are called. So now the private clinics are, or better said, the hospitals are put in a situation where they should compete with the private clinics. But the private clinics get the wealthier people, the wealthiest people, and they get also the cases that pay better than others, while the hospitals have to deal with the situations of public emergency. They have to have a teaching function for doctors and nurses, and also they take everybody and everything, even people that have no money. So to put them in a situation of competition with the private clinics are ruining them, and they are kicking out by hundreds and thousands nurses and doctors, where in particular there are not enough nurses. So it's a big, big scandal. And the hospital, the public hospital, was a symbol of the post-war quality of the public service in France. And what it's targeted is a notion of public service. And this is targeted both by European Union, the control of the European Union, by the City of London, by the British system, and inside France, by all these people who have what De Gaulle will call the world of money, what De Gaulle called the Parti de l'argent, the world of money, the party of money.
Mm-hmm.
And this is involved in the destruction of everything connected to the public sector. At the same time, for example, also in the transportation, before you had a monopoly of the SNCF, the public railway system in France, and it works well. You have these TGVs in the main axis of the country at this point. But now trains from private firms or from other countries can run inside France in a situation of so-called perfect and fair competition with the French railway system. So, of course, this would be absolutely destructive because it has hospitals and private clinics.
Sure.
These people would take the best deals, and the French railway system, public, would have to get everything. So it's a situation where the destruction process is accelerated at this point, and the symbol would be the pensions. Now, what's happening with the pensions? There's a big, big demo on September 7th, and you should watch it very closely, because they have decided to, which seems not to be a tragedy, to prolongate the legal retirement age from 60 to 62. But in fact, to have a full pension, you should be 67 years old, because at 62, most of the people have not their full rights. So
yeah, they're doing the same thing in the United States, talking about raising the age as a way of actually cutting the expenditures.
It's both,
at the same
time, when
you destroy the healthcare system, you're going to lower the average lifespan, so you're going to be paying this out for fewer years.
Yeah,
Doc, we have about 12 minutes to go, and I wanted to get to a couple of other questions. I want to remind our listeners you're listening to Jacques Cheminade, who is a candidate for president of France. Jacques, is the website Solidarité et Progrès, is that where people can find your...
Yes, www.solidaritéetprogrès, in only one word, as with no accent, .org.
.org, okay. And we'll post that somewhere on LaRouche Pub at some point, LaRouche Pack at some point, so people can get a link to it. Now, Jacques, we have a letter or an email to the program from Argentina.
Uh-huh.
Someone who says, "Hi, Jacques, greetings from Argentina, a country I understand you are personally related to." And the question, there are two questions asked. One is, if you were elected president in the 2012 presidential election, would you immediately enter into treaty agreements with the countries of Northern Africa and the Sahel for the long-term financing of an Aerotrain North African high-speed triangle? And secondly, what role do you see for the small, flexible, modular nuclear power plants like Argentina's developing for this kind of transcontinental or inland development drive, which he says also could be used in places such as Haiti, where there's a huge need for power to do water desalination?
If you look at the case of Haiti, for example, the money given to Haiti, of course, was not enough, but most of it went to administrative services, to the money that was given to Haiti went to the helpers and not to the Haitian population. So this has to be stopped. All these parasitical bureaucratic organizations have to be thrown out. And what we need is a true state intervention for a certain type of great projects associated with development. What LaRouche said for Haiti, for example, to have a new housing for all these people. It's a scandal that the period of the diseases is coming with the rains, and these people are only protected by inadequate tents. Sometimes it's plastic, pla- plastic tissue from taken whenever, wherever they can, in whatever form they can. So we need a housing program immediately in a situation like Haiti. We need for the third world these nuclear reactors, high temperature reactors, the type of reactors produced in Argentina, all type of things. We should throw them, even if they are not perfect, we should throw them on these diverse countries to create the energy influx that can maintain the economies and develop the people. Then you connected to that, in Africa, for example, I have a project, the Lake Chad project. The Lake Chad is dying in the center of Africa. It has no water, and there is a desertification. If these things died, you have 30 to 100 million people who are in a disastrous condition. Already in Niger today, there are 7 to 8 million people suffering from malnutrition and hunger. So I made a call. I said, all the European countries, instead of blabbing, should arrange for a plan to develop the Lake Chad with the water coming from the Zaire basin. This is called, this project, we developed it 30 years ago,
right.
Certain Italians developed it, and there was a lot of thinking around a project like that. It doesn't require much money, probably 1 billion to 1.5 billion euros. And with that, you can save Africa. Instead of that, what they are planning is to put this crazy solar system. They want to capture the sun from the Africans and through pipes or whatnot to have this energy brought to Europe. It's incredible. They steal the lives of the Africans. They have stolen the goods. Now they want to steal the sun. So it's an incredible project. The Germans are involved in that. The French also start to be involved. All these crazy, crazy projects. So against that, this highly mobile, very secure nuclear reactors have to be developed. We called for that in Brittany. If you look at the case of Brittany, this peninsula in France, in Brittany they have not enough electricity. The whole country in France has relatively now a good electrical system with the nuclear plants, but they are not building new nuclear plants. So we'll have a problem in the next 10 years with the old nuclear plants and not a renovation. And the emphasis is put by the Sarkozy government on these crazy windmills and the solar energy. So what is needed for Brittany would be like for Africa, a high temperature reactor, a small one, because Brittany is only producing 7 to 8% of the electricity that it needs. The rest comes from the rest of France. So we need something in diverse regions of the world with a careful study to produce the energy that could maintain and develop the community of people with an industrial design. In Brittany, for example, what's happening, we run a candidacy there, what's happening is become a trap for tourists. They want tourists and old people. A lot of British came there because life was less expensive than in England. Now they're coming back to England because life is becoming more expensive with the euro. So that's a crazy situation. We have to get rid of this short-termism. And what we need is a long-term project of the type involving these nuclear reactors of the 150 to 250 megawatts. And we need also these water projects, like the Lake Chad project in Africa, and we need to have cooperation, not only north-south, but south-south. And I think in that sense, Argentina can have a very useful, together with Brazil and other Ibero-American countries with Africa. But this can only work if we have a global change. It needs this four powers agreement that LaRouche is calling for with the United States, Russia, India, and China, and we should kick out Obama for this program to work. For France to be part of this program and to be a catalyst, because there are a lot of people having a lot of interesting ideas in France, but they are not in power. For France to be a catalyst, we have to kick out Sarkozy. And I think in Germany, Merkel is going to disappear by herself quite soon. So a new generation of people has to come to power, and we have to organize the social ferment so as people would not go into a chaotic direction, but we have would discuss on the basis of a true development program based on the creative powers of the human mind for the future. And this is what we are doing in the whole world, but in particular in the United States, where our future is at stake. It's there, the decisive point is there. So what we do in Argentina, what we do in France, what we do in Germany, what we do in countries that have still some Republican impulse against the oligarchical impulse in these countries is part of the impulse given to what's determining inside the United States.
Well, I like the way Mr. LaRouche put it when he talked about governments in the wings, because there are people from the older generation who have been left out but who are competent, including among bankers, even in the Federal Reserve System in the United States. Jacques, we're running really short on time. I wanted to ask you, you've brought this up a couple of times, on the question of Obama. There was a great deal of relief in Europe when Bush was gone and an initial enthusiasm about Obama. Has that changed?
No. Now people are thinking the poor guy, he had to bow to Wall Street. He's a victim of Wall Street. So they don't understand how evil he is. Some do. Some say he's just a sucker. But they don't understand the narrow aspect of his personality, the self-destructive and the nasty mind that he has. And they don't understand that because there is still a lot of confusion about the fact that he is black. So I think that what's happening now in the United States with this Shirley Sherrod case, it's very important. Because Shirley Sherrod and her husband, Charles Sherrod, were activists in the civil rights fight.
Yeah.
And now the Europeans will understand what Obama is doing to his own people and as he's trying to have a new type of Jim Crow policy. And these Europeans would react on that, in particular
well,
in France.
Is there an understanding of the British role in the United States, in particular in the Obama administration? Did the events in the Gulf of Mexico with British Petroleum and Obama's defense of them, did that surprise people, or is that just not known?
It did surprise people, but they have a certain understanding of what happened. The Torre Canyon scandal before in France, which created the same type of, in Britain in particular, the same type of ecological crisis is when they think backwards to that and they look now what's happening with BP in the Gulf of Mexico, people are opening their eyes. So they see Obama as a failure, but they don't see him as a destructive evil.
Or as a self-failure, because as the point Mr. LaRouche made the other day, he's a failed personality who's self-destructive because of this Nero. In fact, the Nero complex is merging into a Hitler in the bunker complex.
Well, you would see that probably on our side in Sarkozy. Sarkozy and Obama are different, of course, but they express the same type of failed personality, one with the ideology, French ideology, the other with the British-American ideology. They express the same type of failing personalities at a certain determining moment of history. They will be out at some point. The whole challenge is how and replaced by what.
And that's the job that we have to perform. And Jacques, we've run out of time. I obviously realize that we could use another hour at least, but I want to thank you for joining us today. Again, our listeners can go to solidaritéetprogrès.org, which is the website of the movement that's backing the Chaminade presidency in France. And also, we'll have coverage on LaRouche PAC as the campaign develops, and you can always go to LaRouchePack and LaRouchePub.com to get material on updates on what's happening with the European Union and Sarkozy. So Jacques, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll do this again soon.
One last thing, keep your cultural optimism, the American cultural optimism. That helps us a lot.
Well, we'll do that.
It helps the world.
Thank you very much, Jacques. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.